name's Tom, and I am an alcoholic.
Hi, Tom.
My sobriety date is September 8th, 1991. I have a sponsor who also has a sponsor, and my home group is the Preamblers Group in Charlottesville. You know, it says in How It Works that our stories disclose in a general way what we were like, what happened, and what we're like now. So I'll try to keep my story general. I don't know about the rest of you, but while I find drunkologues somewhat entertaining, they eventually become very similar and ultimately very boring. And I sometimes wonder if those who tell drunkologues are sharing their experience, strength, and hope, or just bragging. In my own case, my story isn't colorful enough to be bragging. But you know, interestingly, I come from a family of non-drinkers, or so I thought for a while. You know, I have parents who don't drink. They had, you know, no particular aversion to alcohol, but it wasn't like I was raised in a household that was beset by alcohol and alcoholic problems. That said, there's no doubt that I am an alcoholic, as I ultimately discovered. And I also found that as I asked some questions of my parents after I got sober, it turns out that there were quite a few alcoholics in my family. They just weren't identified as such. They were just kind of covered up, and I didn't realize what they were. I grew up in a state where everything was legal at age 18, which meant that we all started drinking pretty much at age 15 or 16, because that's when that's when you could get away with it, you know, go to the pizza parlor and have the beer with it. And beer and other things did a wonderful thing to me. They filled up a void. And I always felt growing up that I was like a quart low, that there was something wrong with me, that, you know, everybody was marching right, left, and I was marching left, right. And it didn't make any difference, you know, how well I did in school. It didn't matter whether I pleased my parents, any of those things. I always felt there was something wrong with me, that I just didn't fit in. There was something missing. And when I started to drink, I was no longer a quart low. Alcohol did wonderful things for me. It was suddenly like, as they say, the title of a very famous book in AA, I had a new pair of glasses. Suddenly everything was in focus and I could fit in. I was the life of the party. I no longer felt weird or some sort of outcast. And so, you know, things were good for a while. I didn't come to grips with alcohol for a very long, long time. The day I got dropped off by my parents to... am I picking up?
Yeah, I think it's just the noise.
Oh, okay. I got dropped off by my parents to go to college on my 18th birthday. And you talk about somebody who was singing Free at Last, Free at Last. There were two things that were instantaneously going to happen. I was going to drink as much as I wanted because it was legal, and I was going to stop going to church because that was just a nuisance. So I managed to free myself immediately. Joined a fraternity, of course. You know, why not? You got to go to a place that has a venue that's focused on alcohol. And, you know, I drank pretty liberally and pretty freely all those 4 years. And I thought everybody was drinking like me. And, of course, when you're that age, it sometimes is the case that everybody is drinking like you. But the non-alcoholics seem to get a grip on reality, and they cut that out. They cut it out amongst many of my friends, but I just didn't notice. I just kept drinking. It went on like that through graduate school and beyond that. And there's a line in the book where it says that, you know, at some point, you know, we probably could have stopped our drinking. We could have had it under control. And I crossed that invisible threshold on some date that I am not familiar with. But I lost all efforts at control. Up until I was probably in my 30s, I could pretty much limit my drinking. And by limit my drinking, I mean I would only drink in the evenings or on the weekends. You know, I made a pact with myself that drinking during the weekdays was a definite no-no because I had a job and I had responsibility. So I managed to pull that off for a long time. And then I got to a point where I thought, well, if I can control my drinking by only drinking in the evenings or on the weekends, I can probably turn it on and turn it off during the weekdays as well. So I experimented with that for a while, and of course, I expanded my drinking to include days of the week as well as evenings and weekends, and didn't have any control whatsoever. So I got to that point where I started to become concerned about my drinking and realized this is a problem and I've got to get it under control. By then, I was doomed. By then, alcohol had me. I didn't realize alcohol had me, but alcohol had me within its grip. So then began the many years of futile efforts to try to control my drinking. I was very lucky. I never lost a job because of drinking. I was never arrested. I never got a DUI. I should have had hundreds of DUIs. I lost track of how many DUIs I should have had. I didn't lose a marriage because of drinking. I was very, very lucky. And somebody once said, well, that means you're a high-bottom drunk. And I've come to believe over time that there's no such thing. Mm-hmm. There are bottoms, and that's all there is. And when you reach your bottom, you know it, and you reach a point of complete desperation and hopelessness and fear. And then if you're fortunate, you find this program. But, yeah, my bottom may have been high to some people, but it was pretty damn low to me. I was drinking every day. I had a hangover every morning. I swore off drinking every morning in the shower. I would never do that again. And long about 2 o'clock, 3 o'clock in the afternoon, I was thinking, well, you know, if I just did it a little differently than I did it yesterday, I could probably pull this off. And, you know, then started all the various and sundry experiments that, you know, the big book talks about. And I started to do things that, you know, I thought were normal. And one of my favorite parts of the big book is the doctor's opinion. There's really great stuff in that part of the book. And the one part that he writes about that really resonates with me is where he said, the alcoholic reaches a point where he cannot tell the true from the false. To him, his life is the only normal one. And I did crazy stuff that clearly wasn't normal by any standards, but I thought it was normal. I mean, you know, even little things like my wife and I would go out to a party. Well, you can't go to a party sober. I mean, you got to get ready. You got to be able to face the other party goers. How do you face them sober? I didn't know how to do that. I didn't have any social skills. You know, I got drunk in a lot of social places, but never picked up any skills. I'll tell you about that in a minute. So I had to, you know, have enough in me to get right for the party. But you didn't want to get to the party too drunk. So I would always drink olive oil to coat my stomach. See, you're all normal drinkers. You're shocked. It didn't shock me. It made sense to me. You know, to me, mine was the only normal life. And I figured, okay, if I'm going to pull this off, I'll drink the olive oil, I'll coat my stomach, and that'll slow down the metabolizing of the alcohol, which means I can drink more and I can drink longer and I won't, you know, fall downstairs or pass out at the party. And it worked occasionally. There were times when my alcohol consumption seemed to wash away that olive oil lining. But I did all sorts of things drunk. And I've come to conclude that being a functioning alcoholic, as most alcoholics I think are, is incredibly hard work. You know, the earth people say we don't have willpower, and if we only exercised our willpower, we could stay sober. We have enormous willpower. You know, we hold jobs and we try to look sober and be drunk at the same time and manage to pull it off most of the time. I was an elected official in Charlottesville. I actually, you know, sat up there and cast votes and did, you know, those sorts of responsible things. I confess to you, I was not always sober when I cast those votes. But I will say, I don't know what your view of local government is, but drunk or sober, how I voted didn't much matter. We seem to get the same outcome. But, you know, the problem with me was that I deluded myself for the longest time into thinking that I had control. And I'll tell one little story on myself. I used to live in town, and the drive from my house to my office was 10 minutes tops. And one Sunday night, I was planning, getting ready to go out of town on Monday on some business, and there was something I needed to get from my office. So it's about 9 o'clock on Sunday night, so I've had a few drinks, and I figure I'll just drive to my office, get my papers, and go home. But of course, I have to have a rider, because God knows during the 10 minutes there or the 10 minutes back, I might be struck sober, and you wouldn't want that. So, you know, I've got a gin and tonic in the cup, and off we go. And on the trip back from the office, I'm going down an area that's like 25 miles an hour, in which the idiots that run the city government should have made 45 miles an hour, in my humble opinion, being one of those idiots. So I pass a police car that's parked on the side, and I said, "Oh, crap." I didn't say exactly that way. I knew that somehow I had the sense that something was very wrong. So I decided to turn off the main road and take the back way to my house just to see if I could throw him off. But he falls in behind me, and the blue lights go on, and I said, "Damn." You know, I managed to drive without getting a ticket all this time, and now it's come to an end. So I decide I've got to try to pass for sober. So the first thing I do is I get out of the car, which is, as you know, you don't do that. You know, but I figured I would show that I was willing to confront the law because I had nothing to hide. So I'll get out of the car. So the officer comes out and says, "You know, you shouldn't have got out of the car." I said, "Well, I'm sorry." He said, "You know how fast you were going?" And of course, the right answer is no, I have no idea. So he asked for my driver's license. So I pull out my wallet and hand him my gym card. I figure this isn't going to go. It's not going to go well. So I finally fumble and find my driver's license, and he looks at it and he says, "Oh, sir, I didn't realize who you were." And I thought, who am I? Because I got to play along with whatever this is, because it's clearly working. So because I was on the city council, all your papers are delivered to your house from the city manager's office by the police. So I was well known to the police because they'd been dropping stuff off at my house for years. So when he saw my name, he knew who I was. And he said, I'm terribly sorry. I didn't really want to inconvenience you. I'm thinking, right. Show me some respect. I mean, it's funny, but I'm embarrassed as I tell this story. That it was such a horse's ass. And he said, well, he said, there's a woman that lives over on that street, and she's always complaining about people driving too fast. So we put radar out every so often and pull people over just to make her happy. So sorry to pull you over. Just drive a little slower next time. And I said, don't worry about it. I'll be happy to comply. And so I'm thinking, I couldn't possibly have a problem with alcohol. I mean, look at that. You know, the one time I'm in danger of getting the DUI I so richly deserve, I managed to skate out of it. So no problem here. And, you know, that kind of thinking kept me drunk for a long time. So what happened? Well, what happened was I was becoming desperate, fearful, and depressed all the time. I was constantly unhappy. All my efforts to control my drinking failed, and I was actually scared for the first time because I thought, alcohol has really got me by the throat, and there's really nothing I can do about it. Back then, there were a number of treatment centers in Charlottesville, all of which ran ads on TV first thing in the morning. Why? I can't imagine. And I felt that they were like calling to me. They somehow knew I was there. But I didn't want to go that route. And one night, my wife and I went to dinner with some good friends of ours. They were good friends because they drank like me. And we got roaring drunk. And the next morning, and I want to say on the record, and I'm saying this even though I know it's being recorded, I think I have the most wonderful, long-suffering wife on the planet. She put up with more garbage than I can possibly hope to describe. And the next morning, give her a copy, right? The next morning, after years of out-of-control drinking, she said something for the first time. She said, you know, I think when we go out with those folks, you drink too much. And that was as close as she could get to nagging me about my drinking. And I remember just sort of being thrown back and thinking, oh my God, the secret's out. She's figured out my drinking, because she figured out my drinking a long time ago. So I thought, well, I got nowhere to run and nowhere to hide now. Now I got to do something about this drinking. So I went and white-knuckled it for 6 weeks. And I thought, this is great. I mean, I finally got it under control. No drinking for 6 weeks. I felt fine physically. Mentally, I was a complete basket case. I was the most horrible, outrageous drunk imaginable. Dry drunk, but drunk nonetheless. Just crazy. So we went out to a football game at the end of those 6 weeks with a couple of my friends. Again, they were my friends because they drank like I did. And I didn't have anything to drink. I lied to them. I came up with one of the, you know, standard alcoholic lies that I'm taking medication, and if I drink and on this medication, something bad will happen, so I can't drink. And they sort of bought it. They didn't like it. So we went to the football game, and then we went out to dinner. And, of course, it being a home football game, you have to wait forever to get a table. So they put us in the bar. And everybody's drinking, and I'm drinking Diet Coke, and I am just miserable, just horrible, just poor me, poor me. So finally we get to the table, and everyone's having a good time except guess who? So I thought, you know, you haven't had anything to drink for 6 weeks. You've been trying to control your drinking. You finally figured it out. You can turn it on, and you can turn it off. And now would be a good time to turn it on. So I had 2 glasses of wine, and that was it. Didn't get intoxicated at all. Felt great the next morning, and I thought, I have discovered it. Eureka. Look at that. Got the drinking totally under control. So I immediately went back to my old habits. And within, I don't know, within a week or two, I was drinking every day more than I had ever consumed in my life. And I'm sure many of you in this room can empathize with that. But from that point forward, I felt like I was catching up and never could. So I had to keep drinking to catch up for that missing 6 weeks when I left my body alone. So a year went by. And I'm reminded of Bill's story where they say, gradually things got worse. Well, they did. And so I finally decided to call a treatment center. And I dialed the number on the cell phone and drove around town for an hour waiting to get the courage to push the send button, which I finally did. And I got this nice lady on the phone and told her that I wanted to see if I needed their services. And she said, well, is your problem drugs or alcohol? I said, drugs? What do you think I am? I said my exact words, my problem would be alcohol. We're not sure. But if I had a problem, it would be alcohol. So I went in and I took the test, and I think it was like 20 questions, and you guys have probably taken the test. And like a good alcoholic, I was pissed off because I only got 18 right. You know, counselor sitting there after the third yes saying, we don't need to keep going. I said, I want to finish the test. I can't remember the two I missed, you know, committed murder while drunk or whatever. But anyhow, but I was ready. I was hopeless, and it worked. I never had another drink in my life. It was all over then. But it was all over at a certain level. You know, I went to treatment to learn how to control my drinking. I did not go to treatment to learn how to become a different person, because I thought I was just fine, thank you very much. And long about week two of this 28-day outpatient program, they said, you know, every Wednesday night you've got to go to an AA meeting. And I said, I don't want to go to an AA meeting. I said, I come to this damn place every day. Now you're going to make me go to an AA meeting on top of hanging out with you people? I said, yes. And they said, and you need to get a big book and we'll give you one. I still have it. It's kind of falling apart, but it's the only one I've ever owned. But they made me go to AA meetings. And they said, you have to have a temporary sponsor before we'll let you go. So, I mean, this is a lot of work. So I went to one of those AA meetings. I was scared to death. To this day, it was 24 years ago, but it's like it was yesterday. I remember what chair in what part of the room at what meeting I was at my first meeting. And I didn't like it, and there were a lot of strange people who came up and introduced themselves, and I didn't know why. So I just wanted to get the hell out of there. I did see somebody who I knew, and I said, would you be my temporary sponsor, because I've got to tell these guys I've got one if they're going to let me go. So he said, sure. So that was great. So then he and I struck up a relationship as sponsor and sponsee. He's a great guy. I believe last year he celebrated 50 years. But he was the perfect sponsor for me, because all he wanted to do was get together once a week and bitch about his ex-wife. And I thought, this is great. I don't want to talk about me. I want to talk about you. And we did. And we did that for a year. And I came out of a meeting about a year into this and bumped into my counselor from my treatment center, who I really liked, who was a really good guy. And I trusted him completely. And so he said, well, how are you doing after a year? And I said, well, I haven't had anything to drink, but I don't feel any better than the day I went into the treatment center. And he said, magic words, what step are you on? And I said, well, you have to understand. I go to those meetings where they say, take what you want and leave the rest. I'd be leaving that alone. And he said, you need to stop going to those meetings, number one. And I said, would you be my sponsor? And he said, sure. And that was momentous. I'm convinced there was a divine plan and operation that put him at that meeting, because I hardly ever saw him at AA meetings, but put him at that meeting on that evening. And we started getting to work. And fortunately for me, he was completely no-nonsense. He did it by the book. We read the book together. Step one was a real big problem for me, because I didn't think my life was unmanageable. I thought I might be powerless over alcohol, so he made me do a written first step, and sure enough, I was powerless over alcohol, and my life was really unmanageable. I had a little more trouble with step two, coming to believe that a power greater than myself could restore me to sanity, because I was a very successful person. Insane people don't become successful. But I say that I'm a lawyer, so some people would say, no. Being insane and successful makes perfect sense. But I didn't have any problem with the God thing. I was all signed up for that. I was raised in the church, absolutely believed in God. But my notion of God was as some sort of cosmic Santa Claus figure that was supposed to bail me out when I needed bailing out and was supposed to grant my wish list when I submitted my wish list and then please stay out of the way. I did not have a lick of faith at all. And, you know, that's something that I've gotten from AA. I believed in God. I didn't have any faith in God. You know, I had faith in myself. And, of course, you could tell where that got me. So, you know, slowly over time, I had to have a spiritual experience. And Appendix 2 is one of my favorite parts of the book because it's, frankly, the story of my life and what happened to me. I did not come into AA to change. And if people had said, you know, part of this program is that you've got to undergo a personality change sufficient to change the way you react to life, I would have been out the door because that wasn't what I signed up for. But slowly over time, doing the steps faithfully, I did develop a faith in a power greater than myself, who I call God. And when I allow it to work, it does work. I'll tell you a quick little story. I represent people who are injured through the negligence of others. I guess that's how they say it on TV. I don't advertise. But back when I was drinking, I represented a minister who had become a quadriplegic as a result of somebody else's negligence. And he was the most cheerful person I'd ever met in my life. The fact that he was paralyzed from the neck down did not seem to get in his way. And I was not quick to see where religious people were right. I think that's an important line from the big book. And a lot of what he said to me didn't make sense until I got sober several years later. But we were going into court on day one of his trial. And he said, Mr. Alvarez, I spoke to the Lord this morning and it's not a good day to go to trial. I said, well, Reverend, there's not much I can do about that. We got a jury in there and we got a judge in there and everybody's ready to go. He says, I'm just telling you. I said, okay. So we're in the midst of picking our jury when one of the jurors keels over dead in the jury box. And the rescue squad comes and carries him away. And my client said, I told you. Okay. So we get a new trial date. 6 months later, we go to trial. God bless him. He was a great man, but he wasn't a great witness. And day one of the trial, he testified, and he didn't do a great job. And as an active alcoholic, I was pretty self-pitying, angry, and unforgiving. I mean, here's a guy paralyzed from the neck down testifying, you know, as if his life depends on it, which in many ways it did. And I'm pissed off because of the effect it's going to have on me. You know, I could be an alcoholic. Ironically, that night, his church was voting on whether to remove him as minister because he was paralyzed. And they didn't think that he should have that job. So he goes from court to his church to defend his very low-paying job. And I'm bitching and moaning to his daughter about what a rotten job he's done on the stand. So she mentions it to him, and he calls me late that night after successfully keeping his job. He won the vote of the vestry. But he said, my daughter says you're unhappy with how things went in court today. And I said, yes, Reverend, I am. I thought your testimony wasn't as good as it could have been. This case has already been decided in a higher court. I said, okay. And he said, besides, he said, don't you have faith? Now, you know, even when you're an alcoholic, that when a minister asks you the question, don't you have faith, there's only one answer. So I lied. I said, yes, of course I do. And then came the words that I didn't understand. I'm sorry. He said, then why don't you let it work for you? And I had no idea what the man was talking about. I do now. I absolutely do now. So faith came to me slowly over time, and it was as a result of the program and the Fellowship of Alcoholics Anonymous. So then I moved on through the steps, and then I came to four, and I thought that was going to be about the end of me. Even though I trusted my sponsor implicitly, even though I knew he could accept anything I said and would not go running from the room, I didn't want to be honest about it. And he said, well, there are three inventories you've got to take. You know, the resentment inventory, the fear inventory, and the sex inventory. And I said, well, I'm going to make this easy for you. Number one, I don't have resentments. Resentments are for lesser people. And other than poisonous snakes, I don't have any fears. And I said, sex inventory, I'm just not going there. That has nothing to do with my drinking. So he said, all right. Well, he says, since you're so well educated and know so much, you're going to have to do some definitional work for me. So I had to get my dictionary out, and I had to write out the dictionary definitions of all the important terms in the inventories of step four, resentment, fear, and sex inventory. And when I realized what those words were about, I realized I had a few things I needed to write down. So he said, you say you have no resentments, but he said, is there something that just pisses you off? I said, all day. I'm pissed off constantly. He said, that's what we're going to write down. And then he said, as for fear, he said, you don't have any fears. Do you have any anxieties? Yeah, I have a lot of anxieties, most of them that I'm going to lose what I have and not get what I want. He said, well, we'll skip the fears and you just write down the anxieties. And he said, as for the sex, he said, I can't help you there. It is what it is. And I said, all right, I'm at least willing. So we did step 4 and step 5, and they worked, and step 6 and step 7, and they worked. Making my amends was a very interesting experience. As a result of this program, I had to be honest with other human beings the first time I was ever honest with other human beings in my life and take ownership of the things I had done and the wrongs that I had perpetrated on people. My problem was that I thought I was the victim, and I thought everybody else was wrong. I could never see my part in it. And one of my favorite lines in the Big Book, which I quote to my sponsees all the time, is, so our problems, we think, were basically of our own making. As soon as I saw that line and took it to heart and understood what it meant, it changed absolutely everything. I didn't think I was responsible for anything that happened in my life, other than, well, good stuff. Don't get me wrong. But all the bad stuff in my life was a result of other people's shortcomings, other people not doing their part, other people not living up to my expectations, and other people not doing the inventory that I had taken for them. I was somehow blessed with this knowledge of what other people's lives should look like and how they should live them. So you might have figured out by now I had no humility. I had zero humility. You know, fortunately, as a result of this program and having had a spiritual experience, I won't say I'm a humble person, but I've got a heck of a lot more humility than I used to have. In Appendix 2, they talk about how change occurs, and often the alcoholic isn't the first to notice the change. And I can still remember. One thing I never liked to do was stand in line. Standing in line was for other people. It was not for me. And I just figured that was because that was what I was entitled to. And my poor, long-suffering wife put up with that for a long time. So not too many weeks into the program, when I was doing it the right way, we were going to go to a movie. And it was a popular movie, I don't know what it was, but there was an extremely long line at the movie theater, and she said, as someone who had been victimized for years, let's not go. It's a terribly long line. And from nowhere, I said, oh, I don't care about lines. Let's just wait. And she looked at me like, are you on drugs? I said, no. Waiting in line just doesn't seem to bother me at all. And I have absolutely no idea why. None whatsoever. So she's told me there have been other moments like that in our marriage. Where it's, I don't live up to expectations. So then I was so taken by that experience, I thought, I need to test this. So I like to do the grocery shopping. So when I'd go to the grocery store, I would deliberately get in the longest line to see how it would impact my serenity. I mean, I'm embarrassed to say this. I mean, I know it sounds kind of dumb, but I did. And I would get in the longest line to just test my serenity, to see how enduring it was. And it endured. I managed not to lose it. Another thing I found was that long lines can be very deceptive. I often moved much faster than some. I was often out before people who were in shorter lines. So I'm just, if I pass along nothing else of value, it is, do not fear long lines. Short lines are not what they're cracked up to be. So things went well. Things got better. I managed to do all the steps with my sponsor. But still, I was kind of waiting to get my diploma from AA, graduate and move on. I had a lot of people say, you know, why are you in AA? And I explain why I'm in AA. And then they say, why do you continue to go? And I said, well, it's kind of like a jet plane. You come down the runway and you take off and you become airborne. And airborne is sobriety. But when you get there, you don't turn the engines off because you've reached cruising altitude. Mm-hmm. You have to keep the engines on. So I have to keep going. I like to say to people that my sobriety has a very short shelf life. When I'm doing everything the right way, I sort of kind of bank some serenity, but I can withdraw what's in the bank very quickly. But I thought, no, when I do the steps early on, when I was not familiar with the steps, I thought, well, when I do the steps, I get to 12, I'm done. I don't have to come to these meetings anymore. And my sponsor said, you won't feel like that when you get to step 12. And when I got to step, after I got to step 12, doing steps 1 through 12 in order, which I'll tell you a little story about in a minute, I didn't want to graduate from AA. I can't imagine graduating from AA. I can't imagine not going to AA meetings every week for the rest of my life. The other thing that is really important to me is 12-step work and giving it away. You know, I am so grateful for the people who created this program and kept it alive so that it was there when I needed it. And, you know, my attitude as a non-sober alcoholic was, you know, give me AA, let me take what I need, and then I'm out the door. And, of course, my attitude is completely different now. And my only question is, you know, how can I give it away? How can I be of service? You know, and as they say, when the hand of AA is extended, I want to be there. And I realize the only way I can keep it is to give it away. One of my favorite lines in the book has to do with the foundation stone of your recovery. And I always ask whenever I tell my story, what is the foundation stone of your recovery? Does anybody know? It's in the book. Nobody? What is the foundation stone of your recovery? People go to meetings? No, the book says helping others is the foundation stone of our recovery. And I didn't know that until somebody quizzed me, so don't feel bad. And, you know, really, that's what I think about on a daily basis, is how can I be of service to others? I have 10 sponsees, I believe, and they keep me busy. And they keep me busy in a good way, because it's kind of like being a school teacher. You know, if you don't know the subject matter, you can't teach it. And I keep it green by working with others as much as I can, because if I don't live it and I don't work it the way the book says I'm supposed to, I can't give it away. As I think page 164, it says, If you don't have it, you can't give it away, or people don't want what you have, or they won't want what you have if you don't have it, which logically follows. The other thing that I think is important when it comes to doing step work is doing them in order. Like I said, I did 1 through 12 in order, but I did 1 through 12 in order after I got my real sponsor. Back in my first year of quasi-sobriety, when I was listening to my first sponsor talk about his ex-wife, I wasn't doing the steps, and so the notion of doing the steps in order didn't mean anything to me. And that really caused me some significant harm, because I did go to one of those meetings that, you know, you're supposed to take what you want, but they were just coincidentally talking about some steps, and they were talking about step 9, and people were talking about how they had repaired relationships by doing step nine, et cetera, et cetera. And that gave me a bad idea, which was that there was someone that I had harmed very badly during my drinking days to whom I genuinely owed an amends. But because I wasn't thinking straight and wasn't thinking clearly, I thought, what I could do is I could make amends to this person and explain how, you know, I used to be a drunk, but I'm not a drunk now and everything's better and maybe you should let me back into your life and maybe I can take advantage of you again by using the program. And I didn't see anything wrong with that thinking. I didn't see anything wrong with it at all. And so I went back to this person and explained how I had been, you know, harmful and how my drinking had been out of control and I needed to be forgiven and I needed to be taken back into confidence, blah, 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 blah. And happily, this person kicked me out, which is exactly what I needed and exactly what I deserved. And this is a person who had been a very good friend of mine for a number of years. And, of course, I just copped an immediate resentment and said, well, screw them. You know, if they don't want to accept this wonderful person back into their life. But, you know, when I went and did the steps as they are supposed to be done, and I got to my eighth step inventory list, this person needed to be put on it. And I needed to make a nine-step amends, a real nine-step amends. And, of course, when I got to step nine the right way and really wanted to make an amends in a genuine way, I had already destroyed the relationship and this person would never talk to me again. Mm-hmm. And so I had to be satisfied with writing a very long letter to which I never got a response. But, of course, the letter wasn't returned, so I'm assuming the letter was received and read. And, you know, that was a nine-step amends done the right way, but nevertheless, I've always felt very, very sad that I screwed something up so badly. So when people say they're in a certain order for a good reason, I believe them. I think that's it. Great. Thank you for having me. I'm honored to be invited to speak. It was a real pleasure, and thank you very much for having me. Thank you.